Bill and I had a lot of things in common in our past. We were not given to analepsis more to prolepsis, but sometimes we did touch on the fact that I also wrote my first book in Spain and finished it there. And we had a sequence. That's where I'm going to focus tonight, is on that area. We had a lot of links. Catalonia, of course, Bard College, which wasn't mentioned. I also did a tour of duty there. And the surprising one I found here in the letters was the information that Bill had bought a bunch of those postcards with the painting, the Rapture painting on it, and had used them, bought a stack of them, and sent them out to everybody. This is when he became so furious against the evangelicals, and I was suffering a similar fury at some point, and also bought a stack of those. So some of our friends probably got duplicates. Amongst those friends, Bill Gass, they became good friends in time. And I got in touch with Bill to see if, since he was invited here tonight and couldn't make it, he's on a short leash from his cardiologist. And I said, do you have anything you'd like to say? And he said, well, you might tell the audience that I am now and then still taken as Gaddis and consequently as dead, and that I enjoy my posthumous existence. When I complain each day about the insanities of mankind, I do so in his semi-astonished, semi-outraged voice. The good news from Bill is that his book, he's beavering away, and his next book, Middle Sea, is due out in March, something we can all look forward to. Bill, as you remember, was the founder of the PDP, the Party of Disappointed Persons, and Bill Gaddis was a charter member of that party. In fact, listening to them on the telephone and the one-liners, which we often had opportunity to do, they were sort of indistinguishable in the content of their disappointed persons' one-liners. I'll be reading from a couple of letters in part two, which is by far the longest segment. It's during the time when he's pushing his way through the writing of his first novel. Always a fascinating and telling period in a life of any young writer, and we've heard some other examples of that here tonight. The section reads like a variant on the classic folk tale as the hero leaves home and sets out on a lonely voyage into magical realms, engages in superhuman contests between light and dark, and overcoming difficult obstacles, breaks the spell of provincialism and ignorance, and returns home with the precious object of his obsessive quest. But in seeming defeat, not glory, weds, but not happily, much less forever after, is sent back into the wilderness of obscurity and poverty, viewed by most not as a hero, but as a false hero, only he and some of those close to him convinced otherwise, until belatedly he emerges from this second ordeal with that fame and fortune he originally sought, and true hero that he was deserved. Most of this story had already been told and retold when Bill and I first met one spring in the mid-1980s at a dinner organized by Donald Barthelme during the week of the annual ingathering of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Though my own beholden relationship to the author went back over 20 years, now over 50, to the Meridian 1962 paperback reprinting of Recognitions. I, by then, in the middle of my own apprenticeship, and feverishly seeking guides through the dark forest and powers, magical or otherwise, to help overcome the demons to be found there. The book had an enormous impact on me at that moment. I've written about that on other occasions. I told him that night of the impact the book had had on me, And thereafter, we enjoyed many such delightful intersections in our lives. Perhaps not becoming friends in the way that friendships are annealed in the early years, as we see in some of these letters, as mine, for example, with Stanley or Angela or Bill Gass, Jack, and others, but getting on very sympathetically in a manner that memory registers as friendship. Many drinks together, tales told, common opinions shared, and around beer, Bill, a lot of wry laughter. Though I was a rare attendee, we got together over the years at other Academy events, usually involving mutual friends, served together on various committees, often for the purpose of finding money for younger writers, supported each other's causes, traveled in Europe together. That photo in the book of Bill with Bill Gass and Mario Vargas Llosa at Penn's Worldwide Writers Congress in New York in 1986 could well have been taken in our hotel room when the plumbing failed in the room we were given. The hotel moved us into a large suite, being the only room they had left to offer. And of course, that was an invitation to us to throw a big party we could ill afford, but could not resist, and all three of those certainly were there. Bill came to Brown in 1988, along with all the other usual suspects, for the celebrated post-mod in-gathering I had organized for Jack Hawk's retirement. And he and actually Bill was featured in the consequent New York Times photos, which would fit well in this collection of photos and letters. We met up in Albany in 93 when Bill was named the New York State author, I having been a member of the three-person advisory panel, and of course, totally unbiased in my opinion. And that may have been, though we had a few Key West phone calls afterwards, the last time we saw each other. We were in Europe a lot in those years and more or less avoiding New York, as was Bill. And Key West was great, he said. All the doctors know exactly how to fill out all those Medicare forms. From his frequent and lengthy letters home to his mother in those early years, part two, we learn that expelled from Harvard, where he had a certain underground notoriety as the Lampoon editor, Bill left home in 47 as a 24-year-old, eventually reached Mexico City, where he began a novel that he had first called Blog, French for kidding, as it were, he told her. But it's really no kidding. It's practically the only thing I think about. I feel possessed. He saw it, as we all tend to do, as a short book and expected to finish it in a few months, ahead of the apocalypse, which at that time, thanks to some au courant pyramid nonsense and the residual feeling, as he calls it in one of the other letters, of constant suspension laid in the Christian myth of the Last Judgment, which heavy, heavy hangs over our heads and imaginary souls, he was seriously anticipating as a kind of revealed prophecy. Well, that idea didn't last long. After 2 years of disruptive Central American adventures, including hard hat labor on the Panama Canal, which we've heard about, and some sort of participation in the Costa Rican Civil War, Bill made it home in 1948 on a banana boat and then set sail just before Christmas on a Polish passenger ship to Spain, continuing by train to Madrid. He had left Mexico allegedly with 10,000 written words, and no doubt many of these are still scattered through the novel, but it was in Spain that he found his book. On Christmas morning, fresh arrived, he took an early train out to the Escorial, soon to become the model for San Zwingli in the first chapter of the book, the Catholic holy place where, to the horror of the folks back home, the Protestant minister's wife is to be buried. He hiked about, reveling in the mountain air, the ebullient birdsong and braying of burros, even, he says, the delicious freshness of cow manure. Attended Christmas Mass, oh, such ritual, what a myth they have, and wrote a long letter to his mother about it. Today is the first day I have felt good about the whole thing. In fact, more at peace than I have ever been in some time, years perhaps, and without the cloud of Mr. T.S. Eliot's articulation hanging over every thought and gesture, though in fact Mr. Eliot would never be far away. There followed an intense, almost feverish exploration of Spain as his novel idea began to take shape, while his mother sent him books and money, ran errands for him, including a trip to the Bronx Zoo to research Barbary apes, another element of the first chapter, and served as a sounding board for his developing writing notions and his continued play with the English language. While she was doing all that, he moved about, improving his Spanish, though hating the food, gorging himself on the great art of the Prado, discovering there his new inspiration, as he said, Hieronymus Bosch, fascinated in particular with Bosch's tabletop painting of the seven deadly sins, which just incidentally or coincidentally turned up on the jacket of my first edition of Prick Songs and Descants. Spent a week in the 14th century Monasterio Real de Guadalupe in Extremadura, which in the book, again in the first chapter, became the model for his Real Monasterio de Nuestra Señora de la Otra Vez, witnessed the spectacular burning of the Fallas in Valencia, went to some bullfights, ended up in Sevilla, which town, after a shaky start, he came to love and feel at home in. We saw that picture of him there by the big bullfight poster. He was somewhat attracted to Catholicism at the time, perhaps under the distant influence of his beloved T.S. Eliot, but by the time I met him, his opinion was that of his 1973 letter to Thomas Altizer, in which he said, "I have come finally to regard Roman Catholicism as the most thoroughly irritating and irrelevant anachronism in sight, and the incongruity of the papacy simply appalling, really surprised at the vehemence of my own feelings." There followed a lost year in Paris, partly consumed by romance, partly by distraction and dithering, but totally wasted, or so he says, until he could finally return to Spain, this time in July 1950 to Catalonia, moving out to Palamos on the Costa Brava, where the writing resumed in earnest. And it was out there on the beach that he met the contemporary British artist John Napper and his wife Pauline, finding in them new and more sophisticated correspondents on whom to test his thoughts and style, and with whom he could talk out all his uncertainties about his future, women, marriage, art, devotion to, etc. Their meeting is described by Pauline in the editor's note attached to the letter. The beach, she said, was almost deserted, except for a solitary figure, a man sitting surrounded by sheets of writing paper, which kept shifting in the slight wind and which he was desperately trying to hold down. When John walked over to help, he asked him if he was English, and Willie replied rather abruptly, "No, I am an American and I'm working." Later, Gaddis came over to apologize for his abruptness and suggested they meet for a drink later at a cafe by the harbor, and they became lifelong friends. "Dear John and Pauline," Bill wrote in September after the couple had left, starting as so often with an Eliot quote, "menaced by monsters, fancy lights, risking enchantment. We had some balloons over Palamos, causing great excitement among the natives, and I, by now unkempt enough to be a member of the local unwashed, we all ran out into the streets, dogs and children, to the point about the lighthouse where these balloons, three of them, rose higher over the hot evening air above land, then came down in the sea, two did, the other carried a little light in its basket. It just went right on up. And that blazing sky, useless to try to describe it. Do you know that point of land? Its view covers the whole harbor, and then around to the east, to the left. I suppose they were meteorological balloons, but we here prefer any pagan to scientific explanation. Aside from that, nothing has happened, nothing. All I know right now is that things reached such a pass this morning in the way of trying to straighten out characters, incidents, situations, interviews, and one suicide, but she, a very old woman, that I wrote everyone on a bit of paper and have spent the afternoon sitting like a simple child making a village of confetti, trying to arrange them in order that will satisfy Aristotle's theory of dramatic unity, William James's of pragmatism, the Boston Watch and Ward Society for Morals, the Catholic Index, the publishers for Something New, the reader's prolepsis and my analepsis. Some must suffer. Boston and the Index first, then Aristotle. I sometimes even imagine cutting it down to myself and the reader. At any rate, it goes on between balloons. I hope you both found the rest here to send you back heavily to work there, but how long does that lust last? I feel like I was born here by this time. It seems as though I've spent my life at this machine, at this window, and staring across at the old man they put on a balcony in the afternoon with a piece of bread and take him in at night. Sometimes the hand shakes and the words, slipping, sliding, perishing, Eliot again, will not stay in place, and I mightily wish you were here for a coffee or a glass at Boodle's. You did leave quite a vacuum on your departure, and I find myself again talking with myself, getting the same vacant variety of answers. Lord, to be a real, legitimate member of a myth, a screaming Catholic, an Albigensian, a Stuart, or Hanover, or John D. Rockefeller, instead of sitting in one damn hall bedroom after another trying to manufacture one. Bill desperately missed their conversations and made a post-Christmas trip to Sussex just to have the opportunity for a few days more. He wrote to them on his return to Sevilla, thanking them for that opportunity, adding, "And the welcome back, people I hadn't seen in almost 2 years, and almost all of them servants or bartenders, etc., but a glowing welcome. It's wonderful and heartbreaking. This lavishness with nothing and such friendship isolates me in embarrassment even more somehow than London's civilized indulgence or Paris's hard, dull, dreary, absurd, pretentious, stupid, tiresome indifference. I don't know what it is Madrid has to make it handsome to me, but it was the 2 days I stayed there on the way down. Brisk, clear weather, and everything seemed white like Cadiz, though I hadn't thought of it as a white city before. But the Prado and the Retiro Park on Sunday afternoon. There is the means of externalizing everything immediately here, a sense of style, place, for everything, and nothing's changed. Still the barrel organs, which bring every sentimental bit of me crying out, and like Odysseus must be tied to the mast as we pass the rock when the where the sirens sing, or I should follow them. I did once in Palamos, did I tell you? Follow one out of town, up the hill toward the cemetery. It was drawn by a pony. But I asked them to play Latani, and it's gone, no longer popular, but always popular, because I asked an old and blind accordionist to play it in a bar a couple of evenings ago, and soon enough, five gypsy girls and women, handsome and dirty, oiled, seams split, and heels run down, were clapping in the corner, which excites me as it did when I first heard it. Now I have to avoid the blind accordionist because he breaks into Latani when his assistant sees me, and it costs a peseta. I got to watch these things. I have a lot of messy notes taken on the spot in real life to go through before the 10 o'clock shout from Isabella, "Don Guillermo, a comer," heralds the evening oil treatment. How I shall always remember what came out of that roasted chicken love from the wounded surgeon. And then, less than 3 months later, though he bravely promises to return soon, but does not, cannot, it is over. It's probably the saddest letter in the collection, which begins, "Dear John and Pauline, I have never before realized how fond I am of Sevilla. But now the fair is coming. Not, I believe, that there is not always the fair here. Right now, we locals are busy stringing canvas up over narrow streets, telling the ugly tourists that it's protection against the sun, but really, it's simply to give the place the atmosphere of a large circus tent interior. And it never ends, the singing and the dancing and the handsome people, though the fair will augment it, 8 excellent bullfights and hundreds of casetas, or small canvas rooms where drink is served, drunk, spilled, offered, hurled. And then on the metalled ways that point back. Oh, I feel such a fool trying to write this, saying and believing the absurdity of this transatlantic direction and taking it. And so the fair will be a final debauch and farewell, final only in the sense of finality of this trip, which has lasted almost 3 years, final in that it will, I hope to God, only be a point of returning, and that you will see me sitting in a state of senile collapse at the port side in Santa Maria when you come there with your canvas and your brushes and your cooking utensils. God, it must be that way. Or you see, they would think, he's now involved in something calculatedly riotous and degeneratedly insane, the Feria at Sevilla. But he returns to sober living when I know that this is living and what they have is insane, is the highest level of calculated insanity ever achieved. I have seen the ruins of Leptis Magna, marble at odd angles, and Sevilla's fair, broken glass piled high, and now New York, already in ruins, though they do not know it. I shall write you again soon, but at the moment, another cart passing shakes the whole house, and I'll go down. I won't say I'm going down on business, on work, on something pressing, that I have to answer 14 letters, that they're waiting for me to open the Cortes or lay a cornerstone, cut a ribbon to open another concrete way toward progress and a future which, like the past, is likely to have no destination. No, I'm going downstairs, through the patio, and out the iron gate, and up past the charcoal seller's shop, down a narrow street and turn right into a narrow one, past the old woman selling lottery, 50 iguales para hoy, 50 iguales me quedan, and out into the sunlight, through the orange trees in the Plaza de la Magdalena, past the fountain toward a sparkling glass.